Reading this morning is from Psalm 78, verses 1 to 7. O my people, hear my teaching. Listen to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter hidden things, things from of old, what we have heard and known, what our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, his power and the wonders he has done. He decreed statutes for Jacob and established the law in Israel, which he commanded our forefathers to teach their children, so that the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn would tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God and would not forget his deeds, but would keep his commandments.
It seems to me that those trenches still grip our imagination. One afternoon last week, I spent an hour or two with some of my nephews and nieces, and they were busy debating which World War I film they were going to watch that evening, and they were choosing between about 15 different films. These are the days, of course, of Netflix. The films come to you, you remain in your own lounge on your own sofa, and you've got a choice, a huge, wide choice. It's also this year 85 years since the start of World War II. But I do think, I reckon, remembrance is making something of a comeback. Just thinking briefly of that old boy I mentioned a few minutes ago in the Care for Veterans home in Worthing. All his life, he says, he has just quietly got on with things until suddenly now they track him down and interview him. Isn't it interesting? I get the impression, I don't know for sure, but I have an impression that the schools are teaching more about the world wars than they used to, more than they did, I think, in my day. And certainly there is no end of films and documentaries still being made. There could be reasons for this, and one of them could be there is now no one left who fought in the 1914 to 18 war, and very few from 1939 to 45. Some, of course, but very few. The Royal British Legion estimates that there are at present about 300,000 survivors who fought, who saw combat in World War II, but that's across all of the countries of the Commonwealth. What the figure would be just in the UK itself, I don't know, much, much smaller. So not many people now are left to represent that generation, that wartime generation, to us. And it seems to me that it produces a slightly new feeling in society, something new, that the memory itself is now more vulnerable than it was just 10, 15, 20 years ago. We need to do more than we did before. We need to make more of an effort to preserve the memory. I do think it's valuable, and it's interesting, but above all, it's valuable to ponder why it is we do what we do, the various elements, the things that make up Remembrance Day in our calendar. We make these imitation poppies and we pin them to our chests. In the local schools, sometimes, I don't know how widespread it is, but I have seen the situations where a head teacher will read out lists of names, those from that particular school who fought and died in the World Wars. Maybe, very often, we stand patiently around a war memorial in the cold wind, perhaps in driving rain sometimes. A bugle sounds. Silence is kept. Everything is very restrained and dignified, and of course even the time of year, the climate, the weather is on the side of remembrance, isn't it? The trees are starting to look gloomy for winter. Have you ever thought if the armistice had been signed in May and not in November, things would have been very different in all these years since, wouldn't we? People out in the sunshine, celebrating and remembering. But no, it's in November. It is curious. I wonder, have you ever thought about this question? It's rather like a funeral, but we are not exactly mourning, are we? And we call it an act of remembrance, but we are talking about things that almost none of us actually remembers. So there's an element of paradox, I think, in the heart of what we're doing. Let's just think for a moment about remembering. We had a little memory test for the children just a few minutes ago, but now it's about us. Okay, just a thought about remembering, one or two questions. You come back into the house, you made a run to Tesco, and you've been back in the house half an hour. Do you remember where you put your keys down? Sometimes you do, and sometimes I think you probably don't. Do you remember what took place at your, let's say, 21st birthday party? It's a bit of a fuzzy old photograph, but that's a bit like a 21st birthday party of yesteryear. Do you remember what took place? Do you remember your own 21st birthday party and who was there and what you all got up to? What happens, though, when somebody who perhaps you haven't seen for a good long time brings along a photo that you hadn't seen before, a photo of that event, and something in the photo surprises you because it doesn't match with your memory, and you think, hold on, was she there? Or something like that. So there's something interesting going on with our memories. You probably remember the floor plan of the house in which you grew up. Do you think you do? I reckon a good number of us do. You probably remember going to see a particular film at the cinema in the days when going to the cinema was once or twice a year, if that, if you were allowed to. Or you might remember how you felt on the first day that you went out to work. I wonder. Those things are all your own, aren't they? Those are personal memory. They belong to you. They live in the privacy of your own mind. And of course, as we know, that can be a little bit haphazard, can't it? It can be involuntary. Things come back to your memory unbidden. You didn't call them up. They just appeared. And the things you want to find, you can't necessarily find. It's not like a well-trained librarian with a library with books in order on the shelves, is it? It's not like that at all. It's very, very unpredictable and haphazard. But despite that, the point is the same. It's your memories, and you are the one who is responsible for trying to keep them, if anybody is. But when we say we are remembering the two world wars, we are doing something which is completely different. Completely different. Two ways in which it's different. For one thing, it's deliberate. It's not involuntary. It's not by chance. It's an act of will. There is an effort required to bring to mind, of course, something that we ourselves didn't experience. So it's something that we have to learn about. We've got to make the effort and read about it, and we depend on conversations with other people. Perhaps conversations you have had with your own parents, your grandparents, those of a previous generation. For a few of us, I know, there is real memory of those years. But for most of us here, there isn't. So it's deliberate, it's an act of will, and also this is not individual. It's corporate. It's shared, isn't it? This is specifically something that we do gathered together in community. So the vital truth, the heart of what goes on today, is that we're doing a very different kind of remembering from what we often call remembering. There is a public affirmation of things today. This is a very, very conscious joint exercise. And there is, in effect, a joint statement. We gather to honor a group of people, a generation that's gone before us, And why specifically? Because of the historical fact of sacrifices that they were willing to make and from which we benefit. Sacrifices they were willing to make and from which we benefit, even though they did not know our names. The verses that we just read, that Tom read to us from Psalm 78, were all about remembering, all about keeping hold of things. And they are specifically about this same kind of remembering, not the personal struggle we all have with our own private personal memory, but rather the need and the duty to keep hold of certain things which define us, certain things which unite us as a people. That's what's going on. That's why it's a very national day. That's why it has a national flavor to it. And those who are from different countries don't necessarily have that shared background, and they don't at first necessarily tune in and identify with what is going on, understandably, if they're not used to the same kind of ceremony and remembering among their own folk. We're talking about collective memory, in other words. This psalm was written by Asaph, the great hymn writer Asaph. Now, he's not as well known as David. We know that David wrote most of the psalms. Asaph comes second in the catalogue of who wrote the psalms. There are 12 psalms to his name, and he is second only to David in that list. And this psalm, Psalm 78, is actually the second longest of all the psalms. It comes after Psalm 119 in that list of fame. This is one of the psalms that reads very like a history book. I'd encourage you to read it. I'd encourage you, if you have a Bible with you, have it open in front of you just now. But also, take the time, make a moment or two, 5 minutes, 10 minutes perhaps, and read it for yourselves. As I said, it's lengthy, 72 verses. It probably covers a double page in most editions of the Bible. It is like an account of history, telling a chronicle of God's actions on behalf of his people, rescuing his people, guiding them, leading them, teaching them, providing for them, fighting their battles for them, and all of that in spite of their disloyalty and their stubbornness and their rebellion. Three things specifically that this psalm tells about that I want us to know about. These were not admittedly in those introductory verses that we read. These come if you follow the psalm through. We read about God's wonders and miracles, his mighty actions carried out on behalf of his people and in full view of all the nation. We read these kinds of things. This is verse 13. He divided the sea and led them through. He guided them with cloud by day and with light from the fire by night. He split the rocks in the desert and gave them water as abundant as the seas. They saw all this. They experienced it. They knew it. It also tells of God's anger. He was angry when they didn't trust him. This is in verse 21. When the Lord heard them, he was very angry. His fire broke out against Jacob, and his wrath rose against Israel, for they did not believe in God or trust in his deliverance. Two aspects of God's character shown in the things that the people experienced. And then one more. It tells of God's patience. This is in verse 37. Their hearts were not loyal to him, yet he was merciful. He forgave their iniquities and did not destroy them. Time after time, he restrained his anger. Now, the point is this. The people of Asaph's generation, much, much later than these events, are not the ones who experienced those things. It was their grandparents, great-grandparents, their ancestors, going back over the generations. They were the ones who had experienced this and known it, but not them. They were a much younger They were the current generation. So why keep on retelling this? And the answer to that question should be very obvious. The new generation needs to know who God is. They need to know who he is, this God of awesome power and willingness to use and display that awesome power, but also this God of righteous anger, and yet also this God of mercy and forgiveness, who ultimately, in the end, reclaims and restores his people. And that, of course, is where we come in. There is an exact parallel with us today. They were a later generation, and we are also, again, a later generation. And we too need to learn and understand about God, don't we? We need to learn about his greatness, and also his holiness, and also his compassion. To learn about those things, we need a pretty thorough description of who he is. A very quick sketch won't do. A quick presentation of God summed up into three or four words is never going to be enough. We've got to find out about his character by hearing of the kind of things he's done. If someone was telling you about a politician of a previous generation that they remember but you don't, some politician or leader or statesman, somebody in the news 30 or 40 years ago, but you've not heard of them. What was that person like? What was he or she really like? Well, they would tell you by telling you the things that they said and did. A quick character sketch with one or two adjectives wouldn't be enough. What did they say and do? And it's not only us who need to know this, is it? That psalm talks very strongly about children, youngsters, the next generation, and the one after that, and the one after that. This is the way Asaph put it in verse 4 of the psalm. We will not hide these things from our children. He commanded our forefathers to teach their children so that the next generation would know them, including the ones yet to be born, and they, in turn, are to teach their children. It's the same principle in the New Testament, of course, isn't it? Whenever the word disciple appears in the New Testament, a disciple is meant to be somebody who learns in order to do what? In order to keep it to themselves? In order to know all about it and be happy and satisfied at home that they've learnt a lot? No, never. Always to become a teacher themselves and teach another generation, another wave of disciples. The others who need to be told are not the children necessarily, but the category of those who do not yet know God. And of course, in our day, more than ever before, people who don't know God very often have a very, very poor background or starting point of what they're going to imagine when you talk about God. What will they immediately think when they hear the first few words? Maybe a comical picture of a kind of cartoon of an old man with a long white beard sitting on a cloud. And that would probably be one of the better options. It could well be the fact that they pin their hopes on the belief that there isn't even a God at all. That's where people are starting from. So a few words are not going to go very far. It needs to be a thorough telling. It needs to be a telling of the whole story, if possible. Now, not all in one go, but we must take every opportunity to tell it, to pass this on. The God who is more than just a smiling figure who is interested in getting to know you. We must have more of a message than that. The God who is awesome in his power and also terrifying in his holiness. And the God who is constantly and utterly dependable in his mercy. Just read through. I would encourage you to do this sometime in your own time. Read through Psalm 78 and you see the depth and the kind of detail that Asaph was willing to go into, all in order to get through to people and to remind them and to get through to those who don't yet know who God is. What's the ultimate goal? He says there in verse 7, this is the last verse of the passage Tom read to us. The goal is that they would put their trust in God and would not forget his deeds but would keep his commands. The mood of that verb has the sense of in order that this is what will happen. They will put their trust in God. They will not forget about him. They will keep his commands. That's the aim. That's the goal. By the way, just a quick aside at this point, and a reminder perhaps. You will remember, many of you, that we've been reading through elements of the adventures of the prophet Jonah in recent weeks. That prophet who was called to serve God's purposes in a very specific way, and at first he didn't, but then afterwards in the end he did. I just want to call on Jonah once more today as a witness, because there is one very specific way in which he illustrates something for us today. Back in chapter 1 of Jonah, you will remember there was that terrible storm, and the ship that was bound for Tarshish suddenly was not going anywhere anymore. It was about to break up and sink with the loss of all on board. And that was when Jonah confessed, "I'm a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the land." Now, I'm convinced that confession means that Jonah knew that the game was up. He was not running away anymore at that point. And I believe he saw the peril of those sailors. He saw that the sailors, their lives were in terrible danger, and he knew they were innocent. Because that storm was a private matter between him and God, wasn't it? The storm was there because of him. Therefore, he could say to them, "Throw me overboard and the sea will be calm." Do you see then how we could interpret that? Jonah was willing to give up his life so that others might be spared. We're looking at an example there in the book of Jonah of somebody who was willing to give up his life so that others would be spared. And isn't that a statement about humanity at its best? At its very, very best. I think we see there, in that example, but of course, you know, today we're looking at other examples of exactly that. We see the pinnacle of humanity. We see men or women at their very, very best. It's the most noble thing that could ever be said about any one of us, when one human being is willing to give up their life for others. Jesus said, "Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." Which is why today, quite rightly, on Remembrance Day, we spend time remembering millions who did do exactly that. Those who did lose their lives on the battlefield and in the situations of war, and those many who were prepared to and survived but perhaps suffered afterwards. We mustn't forget that in the process, it's not just the giving up of life, but the horrors and the nightmares and the ravages of war that they experienced and suffered. And they struggled with pain and sickness and wounds and all of the post-traumatic stress that comes afterwards. Also, think of the fear and the frustration, and very often, I think, the sense of futility that they must have known. Quite rightly, it occurs to me to ponder on this as well, quite rightly, we don't differentiate between them, do we, in any way? We don't make the claim that some of them died more nobly than others did. And we don't draw attention to the fact that some of them must have died as Christians and others must not have died as Christians. That's not a question for us. We are not the judges of that. And it's not a question for today. That will be judged by someone other than us on a different occasion. For today, for now, we just remember all of them together, and we remember what they did, and we do so with very, very great gratitude. But there is one whom we do distinguish from all the others, isn't there? There is one we do distinguish, one who died in an even greater war on a far greater battlefield, And I'm talking about the sacrifice that was made by Jesus Christ on a hilltop outside Jerusalem about 2,000 years ago. There are some similarities. This, of course, this death that I'm talking about, this was also a life freely given up so that others would be spared. That much is the same. The sacrifice, in essence, that far, is the same. Jesus went to his death to secure the survival of others. There are differences, though, aren't there? We might comment on some of the minor ones. In the accounts of Jesus, all through the accounts that we have in the New Testament, even as his life was being given up, there was no fear. There was not a glimmer of fear, I believe, in the evidence of the accounts. No hint of futility, quite the opposite. There was an overriding sense of purpose. And we could draw other contrasts as well. But the main difference is bigger. Bigger, far, far bigger. The main difference is cosmic in its repercussions. Because with the sacrifice of this one life, victory was won. Victory that was, in fact, immediate. And victory that was total and is lasting. Here is a brief description, finally, a brief description written by a soldier somewhere on the Western Front, someone in a field artillery regiment, written on the morning of the 11th of November, 1918. I don't know what time of that morning he was writing this. I think it was shortly before 11 a.m. He wrote this: "There is some cheering across the river, occasional bursts of it as the news is carried to the advanced lines. For the most part, though, we are in silence. Everywhere there is a feeling that it can't be true. For months we have slept under the guns. We cannot comprehend the stillness." I suppose now we could say we can comprehend the stillness. Let's be grateful for the stillness, for the peace that we can know. The peace won for us by the many sacrifices of an earlier generation. And even more, those of us who know the Lord as our Saviour, let's never stop giving thanks for the even greater peace that's been won for us. Not by an armistice, not by a truce that was signed in a railway carriage by weary generals, but by a single once for all sacrifice and the decisive victory that was won as a result.